Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Thursday, June 4th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by John Bryce of USA Today, Drew Mentok of Irish Illustrated. Apparently, guys, there is no offseason off the field because there's always news where Notre Dame is involved. I thought maybe we'd be struggling when we finish on Monday's podcast for this Thursday, but that is not the case at all. Interview with General Manager Mike Martin, and JB, you had a piece on what Pete Pavakwa was heavily involved in. Notre Dame Athletic Director Pete Pavakwa testified before the Senate Commerce Committee Wednesday, the Protect College Sports Act of 2026. I'll turn it over to you, JB. That was great work you did earlier this week.
Well, I appreciate that. Certainly, it has engulfed most of my week. But
you do podcasts, all of that, right? That's just it.
Yeah, and our listeners will be interested to know that when we wrap up here today, I'm headed over for an exclusive sit down with a BYU head coach Kalani Sitake and offensive coordinator Aaron Roderick. So fired up for both of those. That coverage will be in the coming weeks on USA Today. But yeah, most of my week dominated by the things going on in Washington, D.C., particularly the Protect College Sports Act from the Pete Pavakwa angle. He was as involved in Wednesday's testimony as anyone, probably more so because he stayed till the bitter end, whereas Nick Saban had told them in advance, even though he's retired, he had a prior engagement that precluded him from being there the entire time. But Pete Pavakwa just speaking very candidly and talking about it's at a crossroads moment for college athletics. I don't think that any of us is surprised by that. It's been building to that. But Pete talking very openly about how the damage that will be done to the current space of non-revenue sports in collegiate athletics, and certainly Notre Dame has a rich history in non-revenue sports, whether it's lacrosse or fencing or what have you through the years. And Pete is worried. He's rightfully worried. He talked about the impact that it would have not only right now on student athletes, but future generations of student athletes. The thing I hadn't thought as much about that was really drilled down on during Wednesday's 4+ hour proceedings on Capitol Hill is how much it will impact the future Olympics teams of the United States and the Olympic endeavors. And there are just so many issues to consider. Senator Cantwell, one of the bill's co-sponsors, noted yesterday that more than 105 varsity NCAA teams have been cut since 2023, more than 1,000 scholarships in that time. It's going further. Notre Dame has made cuts as recently as this spring. Notre Dame, as we've discussed on here, has informed coaches it will have fewer baseball scholarships. It will have fewer tennis scholarships. It's had budget reductions or budget freezes in a number of other sports. We've talked ad nauseum. There are 9 growth sports, 17 maintained sports. Well, maintain means we're maintaining your presence on campus. You're not maintaining the same operating parameters that you've had in the past. So it's a juncture point for college athletics. I noted this in some of our work Wednesday at USA Today. I've got some more future work coming out of it, and we noted it on last week's pod, and Nick Saban alluded to it yesterday. Candidly, that was some of the most illuminating testimony, in my opinion, on Wednesday was Nick Saban saying, look, the first year we had a collective, I had almost 3 million. It was 7 million the next year, then 10 million, 17 million, and 24 million the first 2 years I was gone. And he said, now we've got college rosters at 40 million. Yeah, again, I'll reiterate, it's expected to be 11 to 13 teams at or above 40 million this year. I've been told point blank, without changes, you'll have to be at 60 million to be competitive in 2027. So there you go. Pete Pavakwa making his stance clear, kind of going both directions by saying a super league is where everybody thinks there'd be most money. He sort of pushed back on that and then offered a schedule that everybody would love. Yeah. So who doesn't want to see Notre Dame, Michigan, Ohio State, Texas, Alabama, Georgia in a round robin format? I still contend there would be Big Ten SEC fatigue. I thought it was poor sportsmanship from the SEC and the Big Ten to kind of jerk the rug out from under both Cruz and Cantwell and all the people who had worked so hard on this bill late Tuesday night to voice their lack of support for it. But they're the bullies. They've got the bully pulpit, and they exercised it.
Yeah, I thought it was noteworthy some of the ways he specifically said they should try and address, for instance, saving Olympic sports, for instance, like having to – if you have a cap that you can actually enforce, which he made very clear, he feels like you cannot enforce it right now. And I think getting that on the record was important. But he said, if you go over this cap, you could have, you know, provide a subsidy, maybe 20-25% of that going to Olympic sports and things like that. So I think a big part of this is just, I think Notre Dame does a good job of not putting themselves into debt for athletics, but that's not the case with a lot of universities across the country. And as we see with professional sports and collective bargaining, sometimes you have to save owners, or in this instance, universities, from themselves, because they're just going to do whatever it takes to be more and more competitive, even at the detriment of their other sports teams or their university as a whole. And another thing they pointed out too, not just Olympic sports, but this could take away from research budgets and other things that are important to the rest of the country that universities often do.
Yeah, again, there's no perfect solution. I was really glad to hear a couple of points alluded to that I've talked about on this podcast and in other radio spots, and that is, if you continue to push toward collective bargaining and you decide you want to make student athletes into employees, you're going to have employees in three buckets: men's and women's basketball and football. And really, that's probably about it from a consensus standpoint across the country. The rest is going to become club sports, not even necessarily, I don't think, the D3 model. I think it would be diminished even further than that. You know, the University of Tennessee has club hockey. The University of Tennessee has club rugby. They're not scholarship. They're not de facto recruited scholarships with official coaches that are school employees, and they're going the D3 model. So I do think that college athletics, which I feel confident saying all three of us really love, and not just because we all love college football, it's at a crossroads. It's standing at the precipice, and without something, and I'm not saying this bill is remotely perfect, I think that they would have a hard time enforcing some of the rules that they've proposed therein, but they've got to get something done, or we heard it said, I've been saying it for years, we're drifting closer and closer to the Super League, and the Super League, I think, would be somewhat boring.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This part's irrelevant, but there's two things about the Super League. I got a text when that tweet came out, or when people started tweeting about it. Bavak was saying that my friends and I talked about a Super League when we were 16 years old, about how fun it would be to watch football in a Super League. And everybody, the adult we talked to, is like, well, yeah, but I mean, these are universities that they're academic universities, their schools or conferences. And 16-year-old mind went to, I don't care about that. I just want to see a Super League where Notre Dame's playing all these teams. And Bavak listed every team you'd want to see Notre Dame play. So that would be, however, anathema to what college football was. However, don't think, other than I agree with you on the potential boring part, JB, I don't think we're that far away from it without calling it a Super League at this point. You just don't play them. You just play crap and then some Super League teams later on in the season.
You're right, but I do still think that there's merit. There's merit in the way that Notre Dame hosted Tennessee State 3 years ago or whatever it was. And there's still merit to some of these matchups and, you know, expand the playoff some, it's needed. But I still think there's a huge difference between the University of Notre Dame Fighting Irish football team and the Fighting Irish football team presented by the University of Notre Dame.
there's a massive
difference there. The volunteers of the Tennessee Valley and Rocky Top, University of Tennessee adjacent. And then we have to talk about all the other factors that involves and how much more government involvement there will be, because all of a sudden Notre Dame Stadium, if you're a private entity, then you're paying rent to be in there every week that the Notre Dame football program is not paying right now because it's part of the university, the institution itself. It becomes even more ambiguous, in my opinion, when you're talking about state land-grant universities having privatized college football teams. And that's where it's headed without some sort of resolution. Again, I don't pretend to be smart enough to have the resolution. I just know that I don't really love the path that it's on.
I had a chance to speak with Notre Dame general manager Mike Martin on Monday, and they kind of framed this story. I was pulling out of my neighborhood, and a former Notre Dame player from the 08 to 11 range lives in the neighborhood. He's always going for walks, and he stopped me, and I told him, I go, I'm actually going to talk to Notre Dame's general manager. And he's like, I heard that term for the first time last year, and I cannot believe that term exists. And that is actually how I began with general manager Mike Martin. You know, your role didn't exist at Notre Dame 3 years ago. It existed some places, not everywhere, 5 years ago. There is, of course, general managers in the SEC, but that was, you know, you're not a decade out. And just talking to him about his first year on the job, JB, you're going to, the part I think you would enjoy is the first thing he did was mention Matt Jansen and Anthony Tresh, saying, "They got me started. There's a model they have. There's scores for every player." And I just find it so fascinating that you have to scout. You don't scout Jeremiah Smith. You don't waste your time with that. But you're scouting anybody you think could get into the portal. And then you start paring it down to, can they come to Notre Dame? Do we want them?
Yeah, it's a fascinating process. There's so much more depth to it than the NFL because there's so many more roster spots and so many more teams that it really is a voluminous task. Mike Martin certainly has found his footing. I think we've noted previously he's been rolled back out with the contract extension, so that's significant. They rebounded well from their early portal struggles. I also talked recently with Mike. I bumped into him in a social setting and we spent some time together. Just really intriguing to see the way that he has adapted and evolved and to see how effective Notre Dame is right now in this entire space. And, you know, I think Chad Bowden set the groundwork for it, but I think it's been elevated even further. And that's because of Marcus Freeman, first and foremost. And it was that way before, and it continues that way. But it's also because of Mike Martin, the way that he's coalesced with Jansen and Tresh that brought in a couple of other guys there from Penn State. Carter Allman continues to just be remarkably valuable glue piece, but what Mike Martin is doing and his knowledge of NFL contracts is more valuable than ever before. And I thought you've done a really great job, T.O., of illuminating that.
Yeah, I agree. It's a definitely great get. And I think I appreciate how you approached it and how he did too with, I mean, he was very open and it was refreshing to him be like, yeah, I didn't know what I was doing at first. And just like how much he had to like pick up and learn how to do for a role that was kind of created. And he mentioned kind of indirectly adapting it from what Chad Bowden had done previously. And he's like, you don't want to be fully detached, but it's definitely different. Yeah. You're not wearing an Irish hat and costume now. You're a guy behind a desk going through contracts. But I thought another really interesting thing was just how he talked about how at first, like the players were a little apprehensive towards him. They didn't know if he was like the boogeyman, I think is how he put it. But just Tay Johnson, that's somebody who kind of broke down that barrier and kind of getting to know him. But it is an interesting thing that I think the players are justified and they're trying to figure out what that role exactly looks like. This is somebody who can affect what they make with the team, but he's also somebody you want to build a relationship with and he's there to support him. So it is a unique role and probably a little different for college kids compared to NFL players who know it's a business going into it. So yeah, I really appreciate what sounded like candor and yeah, just hearing how kind of humble he was about it.
And today's that will be published later on today is probably it was the toughest part of the conversation because that's the toughest part of the job for him is when he has to go to he called it middle body, of course, which is what it is of the roster. It's usually going to be a young guy that didn't play and may not play as much as they had planned and talk to him about a contract negotiation. Well, you say, well, you had to negotiate every contract. Yeah, but these you're negotiating down. And when you're negotiating contracts down and sometimes by a lot, everyone, he tried to use me as an example. He's like, well, how about you show up to your job and find out they're going to pay a lot less to do the same thing and watch other people do the job. And you just, if you think of it that way and you're an 18-year-old player and someone's telling you, yeah, I know that you were worth $300,000 to get you here, but how does the minimum sound right now? That's tough. And I know they don't, that's still the minimum's still a lot more than anybody ever had, a lot more than they would have made. But JB, that's just a hard conversation to have. And that's why he said, I can't be detached. Detached was my word. I always thought GM had to be detached.
Yeah.
Like, I can't be detached. I have to have a relationship with these guys. Otherwise, I can't have this conversation.
Yeah. And as I talk to Mike and as I talk to other GMs around the country, the thing that sticks out to me is there are more GMs following Mike Martin's model and they're shielding more of the coaches from those relationships, particularly the head coach. The head coach, I would say, again, I'm not talking about Marcus Freeman because Marcus Freeman is a unicorn from a relationship building standpoint, but more and more head coaches are being shielded from that component of the roster so that they strictly coach the guy, can help mentor the guy on the field or off the field, but the financials are just truly not being discussed by many head coaches and the players on their roster because of the value of that general manager. I would note, kind of piggybacking on our opening segment conversation, would be if they go to collective bargaining and these guys become employees, and I use the term guys generically, but if these student athletes become employees, then all of a sudden there's a lot less negotiating down because you can be hired and fired, and suddenly there there's a true free agent pool. There's no longer a transfer portal. There's a free agent pool if there's collective bargaining and student athletes become employees.
Very quickly, guys, Manti Te'o and Luther Bradley are on the 2027 College Football Hall of Fame ballot. If you just listen to that sentence, you should be saying, how is Luther Bradley still on a ballot when he's obviously been in the Hall of Fame for 30 years? But that is the way it goes in college football. There are a lot of good players. I hope Manti Te'o's legacy as a player in his senior year is taken from the voters' perspective, as opposed to how he finished his senior year. We talked off the air, offline, in our staff thread, and I kind of mentioned there's a lot of good players out there. I think it's good. It's been 3 years. There's been a Netflix special. He's in the media. I think people can move past the, you know, I call it scandal, the catfishing of the end. Because I like to see Manti Te'o had the best single year you could have. Now there's guys on this list that were 3-time first team consensus All-Americans too. So it's not a slam dunk. But nobody was more decorated 1 year than Manti Te'o as a defensive player.
Yeah, and he was good in 2011 as well.
He was very good. Yeah, he was good.
He was just really otherworldly in 2012. Yeah. And again, that was when I was deep in my SEC coverage and specifically the University of Tennessee. But everybody knew Manti Te'o. I raised it to you guys this week on the staff thread. I don't see how he's not a Hall of Famer. I firmly believe that. Hopefully it's sooner rather than later. The ballot list is incredibly deep. There's a guy like Deion Grant on there from Tennessee who was a multiple-time All-American, helped the Vols win the 98 national title, made some singular plays along the way that everybody remembers. You'd like to see Notre Dame really going hard with a campaign for both of its nominees in this. I'd love to see hype videos inundating social media and everywhere else between now and when the votes unfold.
Yeah, I think Luther Bradley still holds Notre Dame record for most interceptions in his career, which doing that back in the 70s when they didn't pass the ball quite the same. Now, maybe they took more risks as quarterbacks back then, but that's still quite an impressive feat. And I think he played and started on two national championships teams, too. So he's a guy who, to your point, Te'o definitely feels like he should be in there based on the research I've done on him. And I think Te'o has done a good job of, I mean, I think that Netflix documentary probably helped him financially too, but doing things like that has certainly kind of helped massage his image for a lot of the voters, and I think will help him. And yeah, I mean, he finished second in the Heisman voting as a defensive player that year. I think he was the first player in 20 years, defensive only player to finish that high too. So maybe he didn't have the whole body of work, you know, multiple American seasons that some others had, but that one season is pretty historic and special for what he did in 2012.
What he's up against, though, is here's some 2-time or 3-time All-Americans or Heisman winners. Cam Newton, Robert Griffin, Terrell Suggs, A.J. Hawk, 3-time, Percy Harvin, Simeon Rice, Patrick Peterson, Colt McCoy, Barrett Jones, Rocky Kalmus, Chris Carter, Alex Brown, all multiple time, and Luther Bradley, all multiple time first team All-Americans that you have. Interesting things in there like Ken Dorsey and obviously champion Ken Dorsey and Ed. Almost a 2-time champion. He might be in automatically if they beat Ohio State there. And then the winningest QB in Kellen Moore. You always wonder how people will look at the winningest QB, Kellen Moore versus Ken Dorsey playing with Miami. You know, playing with Miami helps you win because Ken Dorsey certainly wasn't the best player on those Miami teams, but he obviously, his college career was tough to top as well. Before we wrap up segment one, I want to give everybody, there are 4 lines you can now bet on. And as Tim Murray has come on Monday Musings and given us some information before, he was spot on with these about a month ago. We talked about them. -24.5 at North Carolina. That's exactly what Tim said. -11.5 at BYU. I think Tim thought it'd be more like 10. -7.5 Miami, which he knew and many others did. And -17.5 spot on by Tim versus SMU. Guys, the other ones will be worse. That's what people don't realize. The other ones will be worse than these.
Yeah, yeah, that was my first thought when SMU is a 3-scorer. Line that this is going to be really bad for the rest of the schedule too. I mean, Wisconsin, we'll see, but Michigan State, even some of the other ones were like, well, we'll see how they are, but that is a home game, but still it's going to be pretty astronomical potentially some of these lines, although we've seen Notre Dame lose as a 20+ point favorite before home too, so maybe those are the ones to watch out for.
Yeah, I kind of think that Wisconsin and Michigan State specifically will be pretty much in that same wheelhouse as North Carolina. North Carolina still has the Belichick buzz and people intrigued there. So you release those early lines in that regard because you probably can engender some early betting just because of the Belichick component. But I really think that Notre Dame will be 23.5-point favorites against Michigan State and Wisconsin. If I was guessing it and trying to peg it right now, that's where I would have that. And you're right, T.O., there's going to be some really, really ugly lines in there. Purdue probably 31.5 or, you know, something crazy. But again, Notre Dame has a schedule of only FBS foes. It's not Notre Dame's fault if some of those are majoring in suck right now.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And there is a bettable line on Notre Dame, 20.5 Wisconsin. Everybody run to their bookie right now. Run down. Do you have bookies anymore? Do you run down to the barbershop and get the cards anymore? Or are you just going?
Am I allowed to admit that you're my bookie?
Yeah, I guess you could. We'll be back with more Bet Talk. Segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from Carl Havoc. Does he wreak a lot of havoc? I'm not sure. With ND announcing $0 in tuition for families with an income under $150,000, does that mean the rev share allocated to football does not need to be used toward funding full scholarships for players that meet that criteria? And if so, was this definitely an idea that came from the football athletic department?
No, this is something that's been discussed, as it was put to me, for a decade or more. This is something that Notre Dame has been very interested in doing from a holistic standpoint for a really long time. There are a number of other schools around the country that have adopted or enacted similar models in recent years. I will say, like, this question, Carl Havoc, has been on our agenda for a couple of weeks now. T.O. had sent it to me, so I tried to do some extra research because Notre Dame, I'm told from within the program, is now funding 100 scholarships. So the over 85, as per the House settlement, is supposed to come from the revenue share. There's still ways that this is definitely beneficial to Notre Dame, depending on how you manipulate the money, basically. So I wouldn't say that this is just an outright way for Notre Dame to game the system based on the people I talk to. But there's no question that people believe it's very beneficial for Notre Dame football. That's on campus, and that is Notre Dame rivals. That's what I want to stress, is like Notre Dame rivals in the SEC and other areas of the country took note of this. They believe that Notre Dame will be able to use this, whether that's extra revenue share to reinvest in the roster because of the way the scholarships are done now, or the way that tuition is done, or what have you. You've got to earmark that. But if you're going to school for free and you were going to school at cost of tuition, then maybe that tuition comes directly to you. I'm not entirely sure of that. That's something that I haven't gotten the sense that Notre Dame is super eager to spell out for not wanting to give away what could potentially be a competitive advantage. But yeah, the short answer would be, I'm told it definitely benefits Notre Dame and Notre Dame football. It's not as easy as saying like, oh, well, they're not using those dollars for this. They automatically can be using those dollars to pay the players.
It's funny, Mike Martin mentioned, you know, I mentioned saving room for walk-ons on the roster, and he mentioned 100 there, and we kind of use that number loosely. He and I use that number loosely, and he made a good point. He's like, preferred walk-ons really help the program, and he was just going to get hard. I offer the name, because he can't say names in these situations. I offer the name, like, Luke Talich as a preferred walk-on wanted to come to Notre Dame, but the next Luke Talich that's that good is going to get paid to go somewhere else, even if it's just $60,000 to get paid to go to a MAC school. That level of walk-on is going to be hard for Notre Dame to get without the scholarship.
And that's real quickly one of the topics that the general managers, some college football preview work for the season that I'm doing. That's one of the topics general managers are talking about. How do we get the bottom 10 guys of our roster, the bottom 15 guys of our roster, good enough that we're not sacrificing practice field quality? That's the big thing right now that guys are scouring. Again, guys, generically, personnel executives, personnel staff are scouring those ranks very intently, trying to ensure that the bottom of their roster is still good enough to give good practice field looks. And so that is one element of roster management, roster construction, that's different. And yeah, you're exactly right. A guy like Luke Talich, a guy like Jake Tefelski, a guy like the local kid there from Mishawaka, Justin Fisher. Yeah. Those guys could, like, in this environment, those guys can go be scholarship players and make $50,000 to $100,000 at a number of places on an annual basis.
Next question from Jimmy McGill, one of the better TV characters of all time. If the 2014 playoff seems inevitable at this point, what are some changes you would make to college football to be able to say, now this is how a 2014 playoff works well?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is just the conference championship games have to go. I mean, from this, the especially at a place like Notre Dame, where they are going to class, where they do have to deal with the academic calendar and the rigors that go with that. That has to go in, and I know that's the reluctance of the SEC, and I think they'd probably be a lot more on board if they didn't have to sacrifice that, but that's the biggest change in it. But without that, it doesn't really work, and you're just asking these players to play way too many games and the calendar to go way too late.
Yeah, the calendar is the number one issue. Again, I think T.O. and I are in strong agreement. The 16, to me, is the sweet spot for tournament participation in major college football, even though that's, again, still a much lower postseason participation rate than basketball, as we've alluded to, that is over 20%, and 24 teams still wouldn't be 20% of all the FBS teams. The conference championship thing, with the calendar being a concern, like if conference championships were going to be a play-in game, a true play-in game to the playoffs, and maybe you had two teams that you knew were already automatic qualifiers and you were going to have your third and fourth teams face off in a conference championship type game, then I could see keeping those around. But otherwise, yeah, the SEC is just digging in because of its partnership and the money that it makes from hosting a game in Atlanta every year. Well, guess what? They've changed the calendar. Everyone can now play week zero starting next year. That way, if you play week zero, you get a second bye over the course of your season, which is going to be important if they expand to 24 teams. Make that opening week zero game an SEC invitational. Pit four teams in Atlanta and play a couple of doubleheaders. And all of a sudden, you're making more money than you could make off a single championship. You could do the same damn thing with the Big Ten in Indianapolis or Chicago. If
you could do it in four different spots.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you could do a Big Ten one with Oregon and USC playing out west. It's the Big Ten.
So quit being so Neanderthalic in your approach to this and just freaking get it done for the people who matter. And that's the student athletes and the coaches and their staffs and families and then the fans.
I mean, my final point on this, if you could somehow litigate a way where you have the Texas Ohio State home and home series on week zero every year, that is also a way to make college football better. That doesn't speak to the money for the conferences, but it does speak to the money for those two conferences, for those two programs. I mean, if you had Notre Dame and Alabama and Ohio State and Texas and four games like that every week zero, put as many teams in play, good 24 teams in the playoff. That's fine. It's supposed to be entertaining. It's supposed to be fun, as Pete Sampson says. You can make it fun if there's a 24 team playoff, because you can't be ducking and playing Marshall and the Citadel when that's happening.
You could make week zero a P4 invitational round robin.
Yes.
And as you alluded to, you could have games in Atlanta. You could have games in Dallas. You could do Indy or Chicago, wherever in the Midwest you want. And then pick Vegas. Vegas is always eager. Allegiant Stadium's a great spot. It's climate controlled. There you go. Then you cater to really all geographic regions. You cater to all four power conferences. You do some really interesting things in that regard, and you solve the conference championship conundrum.
Our next question is from Icy Gold. With so many candidates to be captain this fall, who is your Will Pauling / off the radar candidate to be captain? And who will an NFL bound KVA join as the best players in the last 20 years, Weiss era and on, to not serve as a captain at Notre Dame?
All right, I'm not going to answer part two. I'm going to defer to you guys on that. But my answer to part one is two-part, Jay Nosbury and Luke Talich. And I think both those guys will be worthy, and both those guys will be contenders. And I think both those guys are wired the right way to step up in front of the team and say, I want to be a team captain. T.O., I'm glad I could steal your thunder. Go ahead.
You must have the master key to the school, because you stole my pick last night. I wrote it down on a piece of paper and you found it. Luke Talich is my off-the-radar pick here. Osbury's a really good call. That's a good call as well, because I think he's a leader in that room. Luke Talich is my off-the-radar pick, and I've never gotten it right, ever, so I'm not telling you I'm getting it right this year, but I would be really surprised. Whoever's not on it out of the repeat, Adon Shuler, of course. I think it'll be Adon Shuler, Leonard Moore. Well, Drake Bowen, of course, is a repeat. CJ Carr, Anthony Knapp, and if you go six, Jordan Faison.
Yeah, like, doesn't I think Talich is a great pick. I mean, he's also just his story and him, you know, walking on Notre Dame, being a lifelong fan, all it's done to get here. And they've, you know, Matthias Farley was rewarded as a special teams captain, and he's been an excellent special teams player too. I went with Tay Johnson in part because I think he could be another one of those one and done guys. I think he has like the mentality and just like the effort he puts in on the field and the example. Like, I do think he's actually become a leader out there. I just don't think, as you mentioned, like Knapp, Leonard Moore, CJ Carr, like they're not going to do a fourth junior. So I'd be really surprised if he worked his way in there. But I do think maybe on a team that didn't have so many junior leaders or obvious people, he is a guy who I could see working his way in there.
Good answers. Good answers. All right. Question number four.
Real fast, JB, part two very quickly. Yeah. Drew researched this, but Drew, you have a good list here. But by the way, the dancer, he was pretty good last year that wasn't a captain for Notre Dame football. He's better than Kingston, Billy Amuaso, and everybody else. Go ahead with your list.
Yeah. Jeremiah Love, I think, is the obvious one. And that was, I think, his personal decision not to do that. Yes. I don't believe Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah was ever a captain, which I was surprised by. And I mean, he would have been a first round pick had he not. Julian Love obviously left his junior year. Jerry Tillery, who I know maybe people don't see as positively, but he still was a first round pick and had 8 sacks his last year. Will Fuller, Ronnie Stanley, Stephen Tuitt, Kyle Rudolph, Michael Floyd, Golden Tate, and Jeff Samardzija. And I will say 2010 was BK's first year, and I think they did it by game that year. I wasn't covering the team, obviously, back then. But so maybe some other people would have been mentioned in there that weren't because of that.
Floyd got stripped, actually, in the spring. It was Floyd and Harrison Smith, and Floyd was stripped of it for off-field. Yeah, and then Ronnie Stanley got enough votes to be named captain. And he did not become a captain because he had too many parking tickets at the school. That is a true story.
Wow. As somebody with one or two parking tickets, maybe I need to be careful.
Yeah. That just dinged you in the Irish Illustrated staff captain vote, you freaking slap. All right. Question number four from East Tex 903. What season produced the greatest Notre Dame secondary of all time, and what would this year's group need to accomplish to legitimately claim that title? Timothy O'Malley, the floor is yours.
I tried to go with only ones I've seen, and fortunately that's also in the era of passing the football, so I think it's worthwhile doing it that way. But the 92-93, those are two different seasons. 92 had the best. They just didn't play quite as many good passing teams, but they had first-round pick Tom Carter at corner. They had true freshman Bobby Taylor as the fifth guy who came in at safety. They had future first round picks. I mean, future first round pick, Jeff Burris at safety. They had a fifth round pick, John Covington, a fourth round pick, Willie Clark, who bounced back and forth from safety to corner, or safety to running back, but he played DB in the pros. So that is some talent. You had guys like Sean Wooden joining the team, future NFL player, Greg Lane, 3-year starter. People would point to the 93 year, but that team lost Tom Carter and they did get shredded by Boston College, so I have to go with in the only loss, in the most famous loss, and one of the most famous losses in Notre Dame history. So I go 92. Recent years, it would be, how about 2024? Would be the really good collection. And that is better than 2023, because that was a Don Shuler opposite Xavier Watts, as opposed to the kind of the rotating Ramon Henderson, DJ Brown. So I think you got to go 2024 for most recent.
Yeah, and I think
go ahead, Drew.
With 2024 too, they both 2023, 2024 finished as the first ranked top pass efficiency defense. 2024 did it with a playoff run and facing 8 ranked teams and all those things like that. So I think just if you adjust it for opponent and stuff like that, it was even more impressive.
Yeah, I was merely going to add that 23 secondary got riddled by Tyler Shuck and Louisville, and so there you go.
Yeah, you do have to count the losses. Like, that's why you can't bring up 2025 in the conversation, because there's a reason they went 10-2, and the secondary had a role in going 10-2. Next question, ND Yinzer. Rank these freshmen in order for the most impact this upcoming fall, and we are not going to cheat like Pete Sampson did and automatically assume an injury gets one of the guys on the field, because that's why he had the correct answer to this. But let's just say everybody's healthy. Devin Fitzgerald, Ian Premmer, Rodney Dunham, Jonas Walton.
I'm going to go Premmer, Walton, Dunham, Fitzgerald.
I went Dunham, Fitzgerald, Walton, Premmer.
I went Dunham, Premmer, Walton, Fitzgerald. I just think, cheating, I will say Fitzgerald has more guys to beat out to get into the
rotation. That's a big part for me.
Yeah.
And Walton could be a special teams guy. We don't know. I mean, maybe he's the kickoff guy.
Yeah, he's very fast. You're right. That's true. Yeah. He talked about his speed. So
yeah.
I know guys like talking about their speed, but he talked about his speed in glowing terms. So Jonas Walton can run. And we
I think Walton just adds something different that could get him on the field that they might need that I'm not sure anyone else has at that position. Our next question is from Jay New. Last year, the team averaged an even 42 points per game. Over or under 42.5 points per game for this year's team?
Over.
Over. Over. I don't love the schedule. I love CJ Carr back taking the next step. More weapons at wideout. You're not going to have as many on the ground home runs via Jeremiah Love, but I think CJ Carr will have more explosives downfield.
I went under just because they do play half their schedule as teams that ranked in the bottom 40 in scoring defense last year. But in the last, each of the last 5 years, only one or two teams average more than 42.5 points per game. I think Notre Dame would be a great candidate to do that, but I think my safe bet would be to go under. And if it were like 39.5, 40.5, it would be a tougher call.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they averaged 42 points a game last year, does it? I mean, I guess the 70 helped.
Right.
There's going to be a couple 60 spots this year, though, too, yeah, if they decide to put a couple 60 spots up.
Question number 7 from Zag Domer. In your experience, what school has the best press box food? Which has had the worst? Are there any items you recall being especially good or particularly awful? Offal?
Yeah, nice. I want to shout out very quickly. Last year, this title was won by Notre Dame. It didn't used to be, but last year Notre Dame had the best press box food of everywhere we went. Now, Heinz Field let me down, let everybody down, and made me look like a fool in front of the media because I promised everybody that the only times I'd been to Heinz Field, they had wonderful carving stations of roast beef au jus and everything else you could possibly imagine that all the heart desires, and they had hot dogs this time. So Heinz Field really kind of screwed me over with that one, but it was, you know, it was a morning game, but and eggs or whatever. Jacksonville, I believe it was the Camping World Bowl, which makes it worse instead of the citrus. Horrible, horrible morning egg breakfast. Just terrible. Also, almost you felt like you're off site. I know you've been there before, JB. You walk down to some little tent. You don't even feel like you're in the stadium. That was awful. Yeah, Notre Dame was the best last year. Purdue was bad last year. They stopped feeding people, I think, right around Notre Dame's second touchdown.
Two years ago, but yeah. A couple of quick highlights here. I've covered a couple of Outback Bowls through the year. Unsurprisingly, Outback caters the game, so that's pretty solid. You're sitting there, and all of a sudden, you just smell blooming onions permeating the press box, usually at like 10:30 in the morning because it's an early kickoff on New Year's Day. I've covered some games in the Liberty Bowl. They very often get Rendezvous Ribs to cater, which if you love barbecue, you love Rendezvous. 1-800-HOGS-FLY. Look it up. That's a great, great number. So those are a couple of good ones. There have been some rough ones in the SEC through the year. South Carolina has had a very good press box for dining. Tennessee has been good. Alabama's good. Georgia's very, very hit or miss. Yeah. Purdue.
Georgia had Chick-fil-A. That hit the spot when we were there. The Chick-fil-A for Georgia.
It was, you know, nothing will top, like, from a very tepid standpoint, the game at Yankee Stadium, the Shamrock Series Army game at Yankee Stadium a couple of years ago, or the opener last year against Miami and Hard Rock Stadium, where both times, look, it's never about the media. They're not obligated to feed us. I try to make that point. I don't care. But you could tell they didn't want to feed us at Yankee Stadium or Hard Rock Stadium.
Yeah, I think the Yankee Stadium, too. I mean, because they're not used to feeding baseball parks, the media, they give you like a ticket and you can only go up once, which I can eat one plate of food. That's fine. But then rather than give away seconds, they just threw all the food away by like after halftime. So I think that was on my list. That was the kind of the most frustrating and I guess a little bit wasteful. And then also Boston College, because I think it was the same way that they didn't have a lot of food. It was kind of cramped to get there. And then I think it was all gone before halftime when you would have assumed would have been the ideal time to eat.
Moral of the story there is both the Yankees and Boston College suck. So that's why that you guys should remember that all the time. So, you know, that's how these things work out. I should be mentioning Jerry World. Cowboys suck too. But Jerry World, best food of all time in the playoff. Unfortunately, one of the worst games for Notre Dame fans. Our next question is Statman72. We anticipate reserves will see ample playing time this season. When that happens, it usually means the second or third team comes in as a group late in the game. Why not sprinkle in some backups, maybe starting the second quarter? Or I'll throw in third quarter because people don't do that in the second quarter. For example, putting QB2 in the third quarter, surrounded by the first team offense. That way subs get a sense of what it's like to come in for an injured starter when there's still some game pressure. It's an interesting way of looking at it. I just don't know many coaches that do it.
Yeah, Mark Richt was really good about this, especially early in his Georgia tenure, of always being committed to getting his backup quarterback into the game by the second quarter, typically by the second quarter, certainly no later than the third. I think there's a lot of merit to it. I'm surprised it hasn't become a bit more commonplace, especially as the game is more quarterback centric than ever. If you feel like you have a mature team that can handle it and that you certainly have a mature player like a CJ Carr who you know can handle it, I think there's a lot of merit. I think if you're Notre Dame and you're looking at this year, you worry about what's behind CJ Carr. You try to get those guys experience sooner rather than later, both for any emergency situation in 26 and certainly big picture 27. So I think I think that makes a lot of sense.
I do think Notre Dame's schedule this year particularly could lend to that if they, you know, they are getting up on the first half of their schedule, especially in getting up big. Because you don't want, I mean, obviously a game like Syracuse last year would be an ideal time to do it. You don't want to do it just because you're up three touchdowns and then things kind of falter. So I think there are some ways you want to be cautious as a coach. You want to make sure you're going to win. You don't want to ruin a guy's confidence, or I don't know, as soon as it goes wrong, then everyone's killing you for it too. So I think that that's probably why it's not done as much, is because it's like, why are you putting this guy in the game? That was a little too, I don't know, you might rally the other team a little bit too at that point if it's not officially over.
I'll tell you what, in the Ball State game, Notre Dame on kickoff had their second unit kickoff coverage out there, or kickoff return and coverage out there. They had their number one return man, but their second unit coverage, and they got bundled all over the field. That's to start the game. That's how little they remember. We always talk about Julian Love. Let's face it, we overlook Ball State. That's how much they overlook them. Coaches don't often do that. Marcus won't do that. But I love the idea that Mark Richt and Statman have of number two QB coming in to work with the first unit when you get a three touchdown lead in the second quarter. He doesn't have to go there and throw out routes. He has to go in there, check down to some things. I think that, especially when you're a type of team that knows you have a game in hand, when your defense has a game in hand, it's really hard to sprinkle in more guys. Obviously, a quarterback can make a colossal mistake, but it's better to make a colossal mistake up 21-0 than it is when you have to go into the game, because that's when those colossal mistakes usually happen, not when you're up 21-0. I like this question. He's asked it a couple times. Decided to wait for this podcast. I told Althea, you had to build a team out of one single position. What position would you pick? He asked the question because Notre Dame was recruiting so many defensive linemen. He said, how would the defensive linemen do in this one? But I just decided to tweak it a little bit.
Ahead, yeah, I mean, Drew. I think you'd have to go with, I'd probably go with edge rusher. Another option would be tight end, but just people who are big and can block and potentially get to some athletic weights. But I mean, I'd be curious to see what Bryce Young played a little bit of receiver. I guess he wasn't the most coordinated, but I would be curious what he can do now that he's grown into his body and gets you some different body types. Logan Thomas might have a little easier transition to some of those skill positions right now too. So I think it gives you pretty wide ranging body types there. So that would probably be my pick.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely going the defensive side of the ball, but I wrestled with this, whether I would go with edge or possibly safety, because safeties, those guys have played so many different positions through the years. We're seeing bigger bodied safeties in the college game right now. So I'm definitely going defensive side of the ball. You could make an argument for linebacker, but I'm going with one of those groups for sure.
I'm going running back and finding a way to have Kyron, Love, Audric Estime, Chris Tyree, all those guys out on the field. Audric Estime is my middle linebacker. We're playing football the old-fashioned way, and I have Jeremiah Love now coming off the edge. So you can take Logan Thomas. I'll take Jeremiah Love.
And I know you'd have Aeneas Williams on there, too.
And I have Aeneas Williams on there as well.
He is a football player.
Yeah, there's football players of that group, but I just like the look of Audric in the middle of that defense. Our final question. O'Malley and Priester mentioned Michigan 2019. O'Malley, Matt Freeman, and Pete point to Louisville 2023. Bryce notes the Sugar Bowl win by Notre Dame over Georgia. What am I talking about? These are pregame situations in which you realize you really messed up on your prediction, or maybe one to two where you realize you were really spot on.
You know, I'll say it. I should have been spot on last year against Texas A&M. I thought Notre Dame was ready to run them, and Notre Dame twice had double-digit leads in the first half and should have extended those leads. And so Notre Dame was the better team than Texas A&M. Credit to Texas A&M for winning, especially for the takedown tackle of Donovan Heinisch that helped the Aggies win the game there late. Can't take that away from them, even if it should have been. So, but I was right about that. When Notre Dame was the better team, Notre Dame was up 17-7, 24-14. It should have been 31-14 or 24-7 or whatever. So I feel good about that one. I would say I felt for sure that Notre Dame was going to win at Texas A&M, especially pregame, how locked in. It was sweltering down there, but we were all on the field. They were really locked in. I felt good about that one. I'm trying to think. Michigan, I was at that Michigan game in 2019 up in Ann Arbor, and you sensed pretty early on that Notre Dame didn't want to be there, and Michigan's whole team was out there shirtless in an unbelievable monsoon. So I would add that one to it. There have been some in the SEC through the years. I've been fortunate to be a guest at some LSU games and be on the sideline down there pre-Brian Kelly. And, you know, there are a couple of times that I thought that Alabama would roll the Tigers and some of Saban's better teams, and that didn't happen.
I want to say I picked against Notre Dame for the 2023 Ohio State game. Once we got there, I felt like, oh, Notre Dame is going to win this. And then they probably should have won that and then didn't, obviously, for obvious reasons. But the one where I feel like I got right is I picked Notre Dame to beat Clemson at home in 2022. And then I think as soon as we got there, I felt pretty good about that. And then I didn't expect them to beat them by 20 right. plus points like they did. But I felt good about that once I got into the stadium.
That's funny because Clemson is my answer twice in back-to-back years. I showed up in 2022, and, well, my answer is Michigan because I walked up the elevator and Priester had the look on his face like, I go, what's wrong? He goes, I don't like the looks of this. And I looked down, I was like, it doesn't look that good either. Notre Dame's in trouble. And Louisville on the field, you could just tell. Notre Dame was so just detached. There's your word. They were detached from that. There was an ex-Notre Dame coach was down there, too. We're like, what is wrong with this situation? He couldn't believe it. Clemson 2022, I was very heavy on Notre Dame. I picked Notre Dame to beat Clemson 2023. We were there, and I'm like, did we all just get hoodwinked before the game started? Like, did the whole media, the whole Notre Dame media pick Notre Dame to beat Clemson in 2023 at Clemson in a 3-point spread? I'm like, something's off here. It wasn't as off as Louisville and Michigan, but I was thinking this is not a great situation for Notre Dame. And I know that's like boogeyman stuff, the whole media picking it, but I feel like we really overlooked what Clemson could still do as a football team at that point, and that Notre Dame was far from perfect at that point as well.
Notre Dame far from perfect, but even Clemson that morning had more players, key players ruled out. I mean, they had Will Shipley ruled out of that game, but, you know, and Notre Dame had ample opportunity to win that game, whether it was a special teams turnover or red zone inefficiencies or interceptions and ghosts on the field and whatever else.
I'd have to go back and find it, but that 2023 Louisville game, at some point before that, because the previous year Sam Hartman had turned the ball over 6 times against them, and somebody asked him why he struggled, and he said, I wouldn't say I struggled, was his response. And that was when I was like, I don't think they're gonna win that game. I don't remember when that quote was said, but I remember that was when I didn't have a feeling.
That's pretty good. I did not pick Notre Dame to beat Alabama in either time, but in 2012 I beat Manti Te'o to his thought about Alabama by 48 hours when I went to media day and I saw Alabama's players walk out and everybody went, oh,
yeah,
that's an issue. And then Manti Te'o admitted he saw that when he was in the tunnel. But Manti Te'o should be in the Hall of Fame, and I will be voting for him. I vote for the Hall of Fame. He was just a good prognosticator. He looked over there and saw how good Alabama was. And this was a fun podcast, guys. John Bryce, thanks for joining us. I know you have a quick out. You may have to bounce right now for the peace sign. And Drew Metcalf from Irish Illustrated, Jack Freeman from behind the camera. I'm Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.